This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're going to focus on some archival interviews about Iran as the country has been in the headlines in recent weeks. We'll begin by listening to my interview with Azar Nafisi, the Iranian-born author who challenged the repressive government through literature. Prior to the Iranian Revolution, she taught at Tehran University, which she chronicled in her best-selling book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. She joined me in 2014 to discuss her latest book, The Republic of Imagination. It's about the virtues of literature and how American writers changed her life as a young Iranian woman. Let's listen. You begin your book by describing this tutor that you had when you were, I think, about 7 years old, reading The Wizard of Oz, the wonderful Wizard of Oz to you, giving it to you in little bites so that you were sort of expecting, you know, looking for her to come back and read some more. Was that your first introduction to American books?
Yes, it was my first introduction to American books. And I guess that later on, of course, I interpreted it in this way. But then America became a place where, at the heart of a place called Kansas, which was like a desert, you have a cyclone, at the heart of which there is this wondrous world. Dorothy, of course, her journey is about independence and finding out that she doesn't need to rely on the power of the wizard. She is the wizard, you know. So that was
an important message.
That was the America I imagined.
As a young girl, you were sent away to go to school.
Yes.
You had to sort of hide within your own country of Iran. Now you're an American citizen, but you've had to sort of carry this idea of country and perhaps even belonging in your head.
You know, from very early childhood, because my father, the stories he would tell me would not just be about the fabulous Iranian tales and mythology. You know, one day we'll go to Italy with Pinocchio, and next day we go to France with Little Prince, then we go to America with Charlotte's Web, you know. So the whole point is that for me, that concept stayed, that there is a portable home, which is that Republic of Imagination. It is both in your backyard, because you need to go there to get away from the habits and routines of life and look at life differently. And I can take it anywhere.
Do you think that's something that immigrants either have to do or perhaps know how to do better than people that don't, that have, you know, one essential country?
Yes, I think so. Of course, people who have one essential country, they will understand that one hurricane or a war or a revolution can take everything away from them that they called home. So the concept of home seems very secure, but actual physical real home is not secure at all. What is enduring is that Republic of Imagination, because you carry it in your memory, and no one can take away your memory from you, and no one can take away your ideas or your imagination away from you. That is how I made my home in America later on.
You chose three, really four books in your book, Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Country, and also James Baldwin's Another Country. Is there something that ties these four books together in your imagination?
Well, yes, definitely. I was, when I became a little bit frustrated with the denigration of imagination in America today, especially by our elite, the only place I could go to was its works of imagination, that imaginary map I had in my mind. And I started with 24 authors, but it was impossible to
24.
Do that. Yeah, because you couldn't do them justice. And I started with Mark Twain because I think Mark Twain, as Hemingway and Fitzgerald and so many other authors say, is really the beginning of a new way of writing fiction in this country. And I feel that Huck Finn is his literary declaration of independence. We could not compete with Europe and other countries in terms of the layers of culture with Shakespeare and Molière and Dante and Ferdowsi. But we had, but Americans had something no one else had. They had something absolutely new. So their imagination could create a new man, a new woman. And that is what Mark Twain did in Huckleberry Finn. He created a new landscape and a new perspective for all of us.
Huck is also a bit of a mongrel, if I can say, an outcast.
Yes.
And it seems that that represents a lot to you. That means something very powerful to you.
Actually, you asked the reason I chose these books. One reason was that I wanted to choose The Outcasts because the characters, the heroes of American, best American fiction are usually homeless and restless. You know, they're constantly looking to new, towards new horizons, something that we are not doing very well today. And would Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain has this beautiful tongue-in-cheek speech, not just against the European ancestors, but against what he calls the Mayflower tribe. And he says, "You deprived us, deprived me of all my ancestors," you know, beginning with the Native Americans, going through Quakers, the witches, and ending with the slaves. And he says, "For I am a many-shaded, exquisite mongrel."
Mm.
You know, and I think that that is the best thing about America. And Huck is the best thing about America. He turns everything that is respectable and defined and conventional on its head. He reverses all these words and gives us a new insight into what the world should be. And he's only a little boy.
And he's only, well, oftentimes out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yes, yes.
But even looking at these other books as well, and even other American writers, you describe America, the sort of creative Americans, as having or being perhaps the moral voice of the country.
Definitely. Definitely. I have never, I mean, all fiction is moral in essence.
Good fiction.
All great fiction, yes. And the others are very dictatorship. They impose their voice on everyone else. But great fiction is in essence democratic because it is about giving voice to everyone, even the villain. And at the same time, like Huck, there is the issue of individual choice and individual independence of mind. And once Huck meets Jim, he's resurrected through Jim's eyes, and his relationship with Jim turns him at each step into a more moral person, till at the end he believes he might go to hell if he give up Jim. Hmm. But he says, "I rather go to hell." And he says, "My heart was doing the wrong thing against my conscience. I just told myself, I go to hell, but I will save Jim." And that relationship between Jim and Huck is essential in Mark Twain and essential in American society.
You taught Huckleberry Finn. I mean, that was one of the books that you taught.
It was the first book.
When you were teaching in Iran. And, did the students there understand this book the way you do now?
The focus, because of the repression, was also on the respectable society and the smothery towns Huck Finn. And we talked about this concept that wilderness, which is supposed to be not safe, is the safe place for Huck and Jim, while those civilized towns are where the danger lies and the violence. My students understood well how conformity breeds violence. Something that we do not understand here, because Huck Finn, Babbitt, Carson McCullers, and Baldwin are all against conformity in their own ways, but they also, their heart broke for Jim. You know,
that and perhaps identified with him.
They identified with him, and especially when a totalitarian society strips you of your individuality, you know, you become the enemy, and so you can be killed. And when I would talk up to them about the fact that Huck empathizes with Jim because a father should not be separated from his children, that is how Mark Twain criticizes racism, not through rants, you know. And they understood that very well because their individuality was being stripped as well.
Do you think, though, I mean, that all books should be read by all children, no matter their age? Or so I guess sort of how open are you to people being open to literature?
Well, I think that people should be open to literature and people should choose quality books, books that bring to us the ambiguity and the complexity of life. And look at the great fairy tales or children's stories. I mean, Charlotte's Web, for example, you know, teaches you empathy in the first paragraph, you know, and the way that people can connect and individualism at its best. You rebel, but you don't rebel for rebellion's sake, or you don't rebel because it's a doggy dog world and I want to, you know, I'm the cowboy in town. you rebel because you want to connect and do the right thing. This is what our children should be taught. And at every age, there are great books. And I disagree with preaching to children and choosing stories that are only didactic rather than we should respect the readers.
You had some good teachers in your life?
Yes, yes. I had good teachers. I had teachers who were passionate. I had teachers who made me connect to the book before they imposed their own ideas on me, which is what I'm trying to do with my students. I owe a great deal to that first teacher in Iran who read Wizard of Oz to me, you know. And we do need good teachers, but we need to respect teachers. We need to, when we talk about vocation, we need to think of teaching as the highest vocation.
You said you wrote this book because an Iranian man came up to you, and I'll just quote here. He said to you, these people over in, you happen to be in Seattle, these people over in Seattle don't care. They don't like to read books.
And of course, you know that Seattle is one of the cities where people...
I was going to say, that's where people actually do read books.
But he also meant Americans as a whole. And I've heard that from my former students who are now in Washington, D.C.
But do you think... do you think he's right?
Well, no. And that question sort of haunted me because during my travels, a lot of people would say, why is it that repressed countries appreciate books? And to tell you the truth, there contradictory feelings that I have towards it. On one hand, we're cutting funds for music, books, writing, all the things that young man and people like him are giving their lives for. On the other hand, during these travels, Marty, it was amazing. Red states, blue states, big cities, small cities. You have this throngs of people. There are book groups, there are students, there are young people. All of them come because they love books.
Yes.
You know, and I've connected to so many people in this country because of books. So I had to write this book partly for Ramin, for this young man, to tell him there's another side and we need to connect to that side and unite with that side.
That was my 2014 interview with Iranian-born author and educator Azar Nafisi about her book, The Republic of Imagination. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from the three American hikers who were held captive in the notorious Evin prison in Iran. Stay with us. شهر خاموش دلم رو تو پرآوازه کردی آتش این عشق کهنه دیگه خاکستری بود اومدی وقتی تو سینه نفس آخری بود به عشق تو زنده بودم منو کشتی دوباره زنده کردی دوست داشتم دوستم داشتی منو کشتی دوباره زنده کردی Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Last weekend, the U.S. engaged in a prisoner swap with Iran just as the landmark nuclear agreement went into effect. The American captives, including journalist Jason Rezaian, were held in the infamous Evin prison. 2 years ago, we were joined by three Americans who also endured imprisonment in Evin. In 2009, they were captured by Iranian officials while hiking along the Iran-Iraq border and were accused of espionage. Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Shroud spent many months in captivity. But after public advocacy by celebrities and politicians alike, they were released and returned home. They co-authored a book about their experiences called Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Let's take a listen. I think it was in one of your chapters, Sarah, where one of the guards says to you, you came here for vacation. I mean, they were, I think, pretty shocked that three Americans would be vacationing in this part of Iraq and then obviously ending up in Iran.
I think, yeah, that guard was Layla. Well, she was my favorite guard. She was really tough, but she also had a really soft side. We could speak Arabic together, so we communicated better than others. And she said, I know you were just here for sport in the Zagros Mountains. And actually, the guards were really proud of the beauty of Iran, you know, of the natural beauty. And that extends into Kurdistan. So they would boast about it, and they can understand why someone would want to spend time there.
But I have to say, I mean, it sounded pretty scary to be essentially arrested, taken by these guards. I'm looking at you, Josh, and put in a car and driven, eventually accused of espionage. Yeah.
Well, it was almost, you know, when guards would ask, they would a lot of the time throughout, even towards the end of my detention there, they would say, well, what do you think of Iran? Isn't it? It's beautiful. What do you? They had so much pride in their country.
Right.
And it seemed beautiful. You know, the mountains were beautiful. And on the drive from western Iran on the border to Tehran, it looked very beautiful. But it was a tough question to answer because, you know, my experience in Iran was from the border to a prison.
Sure.
So it wasn't the most pleasant. But the thing was, I did experience many Irans, and perhaps we'll talk about that later, of all the different, you know, good and bad guards and interesting encounters we had with other prisoners.
Yeah, I'm trying to put myself into your place and imagine what it would be like, especially to be accused of espionage.
Well, you know, we didn't know exactly, you know, what the charges would be and how it would go. And at first it seemed like perhaps we would just get released. And I remember actually on the ride down from the mountain, they put us in a car, and we drove down the mountain, and we immediately went to a police station. Well, immediately bought a hijab for Sarah.
That's right.
Because
mm-hmm.
we were so, you know, not prepared to be in Iran. But then they took us to a police station, and at that police station there was a man there who kind of like went off on this little bit of a tirade about how Americans had detained these Iranians in Iraq and how they had kept them for over 2 years, and he was like yelling about 2 years. Can you believe it? And I remember like not having heard of this and feeling like, I have nothing to do with that. That was just day one.
Exactly, day one. I have interviewed people who have been in Evin prison in Tehran, and it's a place where, I guess, where criminals go, where political prisoners go. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a pretty frightening place. Could you describe it for our listeners?
Yeah, well, Evin prison is a very large prison, and we didn't even know that we were in Evin prison for months. We were blindfolded and brought there. But the places that we were in, two different parts of Evin prison, both were political prisons. They were, you know, the people that were there were pro-democracy activists, people that were part of unpopular faiths, maybe professors who had said something the government didn't like abroad. Everyone's in isolation who's a political prisoner. You know, either they're in solitary confinement or they're in a cell with other inmates, but they can't interact. They're not allowed to interact with other prisoners. And when they leave the cell, they're blindfolded. When they're interrogated, they're in soundproof rooms, blindfolded. And, you know, we heard at times devastating screams. And, you know, we would manage to sneak conversations with other prisoners in neighboring cells. And some of them, you know, told me that they had had their hair pulled out, that they had been beaten, that someone told Josh that he had been electrocuted.
The two of you shared a cell. I mean, you did spend time in solitary, but you did share a cell and managed to sort of create activities and things that could keep you occupied.
Indeed. And I just wanted to add about the timing of our arrest. You know, when there was all these protests, as Sarah mentioned, and it's like it seems to be universal that whenever there's a protest and that the government that's being protested says that it's started by outsiders. And so that became the fear. And I remember when we met the Swiss ambassador after a couple months, and she represents U.S. interests in Iran because the U.S. doesn't have an embassy there. And she said, you know, the timing of your arrest is not good. And so that became kind of the worry. Right. And a few months later when we got put together, Shane and I, it was at first such a relief because you know, sometimes the best pleasure in life is just relief from pain, and that's what happened in the beginning of when Shane and I were together, because that was the end of solitary, total solitary confinement for us.
Sarah, you were in solitary confinement for more than 400 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you have many chapters and many descriptions in this book about what it was like for you. And the way you describe it is that it was torture.
Yeah. In the early weeks and months, I couldn't sleep. I was just constantly in a panic attack, and I would pace my cell compulsively. I would crouch by the small slot, the food slot, in the cell door, just trying to hear any sounds, whether it's footsteps or other prisoners coughing, to orient myself in the world.
Did you have nothing in the cell, essentially, to occupy your mind?
In the beginning, no. There was no bed. It was just an empty cell with a blanket.
No book. No.
They let us, after a few weeks, they let us have the book that we brought with us, and we passed. They passed it back and forth between the three of us, and we read that book many, many times. The solitary confinement slows down your brain. Studies have shown that after 2 to 3 days, the brain waves shift towards stupor or delirium. So it's really trying to keep yourself on track, keep yourself vigilant. I would recite multiplication tables in my head. I would sing songs at the top of my lungs. But there were times that I couldn't fight it any longer, that I was overwhelmed by depression and rage, and I screamed and even beat at the walls of my cell. But the majority of time was spent just really exercising, keeping myself disciplined. And there were beautiful moments. There were always things that brought me back from the edge of sanity.
Mm.
There's, in the book, I describe waking up early one morning, and the sliver of light from my window came into my cell, and there were all these dust motes
floating in the air.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. And I was overwhelmed by a sense of beauty. It reminded me of the beauty of the world. It was like a microcosm, and every dust mote was a different person from my life, and I had a sense of peace that even if I never got out of that cell, the world would go on without me, and it was a beautiful world.
Did you think you were going to lose your mind, or did you feel at times you were losing your mind?
Yeah, I think everyone that I've talked to that goes through prolonged solitary confinement has times where they either lose their mind or get very close. It's just a matter of, can you get back? And eventually, when I had too many breakdowns and the interrogators were afraid I was going to hurt myself, and I beat at the walls of my cell, they gave me time with Shane and Josh in the open air cell that we called Havahori, which means eating fresh air.
Mm.
And that became my lifeline. Everything, it gave me something to look forward to every single day. I was still in solitary confinement because the UN says that anything from 22 to 23 hours alone is solitary confinement. And, of course, 15 days, according to the UN, can cause permanent psychological damage and constitute torture. And I was in for 410 days. Shane and Josh were in for over 4 months. So we were all psychologically tortured.
Do you feel like you were psychologically damaged by what happened there?
Well, yeah. It took
years. Even today?
I'm pretty much back to the new normal.
New normal, right.
I've been able to really turn my experience into something positive. The work that I do with prisoners in solitary confinement in this country, writing our book, Shane and I have walked each other through every step of the process of recovery, but not everyone does recover.
Yeah. Shane, go ahead.
Yeah, there were times that, after Josh and I got put back together, we were allowed to see Sarah for a period of time each day in this kind of open-air cell. And there were times that I thought that Sarah was not going to be the same person when she got out. I remember, especially when Josh and I first got put together, it was just... It was kind of there was a relief to being with Josh, but in a way it was worse because Sarah was still alone, and I remember going out to the cell, this open air cell one day, and Sarah just had this look of total devastation in her face, and she started just kicking the wall, and I physically grabbed her and pulled her away, and it was like restraining her, and trying to calm her down, and so these violent outbursts, but there were also, as the months passed, this kind of withering away of her. And Josh and I were just kind of constantly trying to figure out how to bring her out of that. And, fortunately, she got out after a year.
Well, in fact, Sarah, you write in the book, ever since I found out that Shane and Josh were put together, I've been full of uncontrollable anger at everything and everyone. And hate, almost violent hate. I feel like I have lost them. I mean, the thought that they were together, but you were alone, even for and you had this, an hour something a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I knew it was completely be out of their control and that I couldn't blame them. But you battle with a lot of inner demons. Mm-hmm. And that's the process. And that's ultimately what I think saved me, is that it became we realized together that everything we did had to be resistance to those conditions, so that we wouldn't become that place, so we wouldn't be institutionalized. So I hated the fact that the guards could always look through a peephole and see me. So I started to cover the peephole with blue shampoo so they couldn't see me anymore. And they'd wipe it off and I'd just put it back on. And there are a million little ways we found to resist those conditions.
Including hunger strikes. I mean, you would go on hunger strikes to protest mm-hmm. things.
Yeah, we actually, when we were coming across the country, before we were brought to Evin prison, we all decided that if we were separated, we would go on hunger strike until they put us back together. And it didn't. Ultimately, they gave us, you know, a meal together, which at that time, just, you know, 5 days apart, was such a relief to see each other and know that we were okay. The other people were okay. And then later, after throughout solitary confinement, I had gone on a couple of hunger strikes. And then after Sarah was released, Josh and I kind of got into a routine of hunger strikes where we wouldn't, after Sarah got out, they kind of, you know, they weren't as vigilant with us. They wouldn't bring us letters from family. And we would, you know, we're constantly going on hunger strikes just to get those letters mm-hmm. and that kind of news from the outside.
Josh, this goes back to I guess some of the earlier time in Evin, but you talk about finding a pen full of ink, and you also write, the written word has become my closest friend. The fact that you could write something.
Being able to write allowed me.
And you're writing now during the hour, I noticed.
I'm writing during the hour.
You are. You've got pens and pens.
Many of them.
You do. It's okay. I've been watching you. It's okay.
It's not PTSD. It maybe is PTSD. No, I don't know if it's PTSD.
Well, whatever. It's fine. It's fine. I just could not notice.
Yeah, no, actually, I just bought these yesterday. I thought they were gorgeous. and, you know, writing was, it was a way to be able to see myself, to be able to have a conversation. I was having no conversations. And that was the miserable part, to just have zero conversations in a day. I remember that's why I would look forward to interrogation. I mean, interrogation was horrible, but I wanted it because at least I could have a conversation. In the first 30 days, the guards would, when they would come to give me food or anything, they would just slip it to me without letting me see them anything beyond their hand. And then after 30 days, they started, I began being able to have at least, you know, often a conversation in charades, to be able to communicate between languages. But writing became that for me. It became a way, at least I could talk to myself. And when we got a couple books, it was then I could talk to authors, even if they were in 19th century Russia or the past or some other time. The mind just started to dull down. And I remember wanting guards to come, even if they were going to be mean to me.
Because, just to have an interaction.
Because it was better than, it was at least emotion. I felt like my mind is just getting dull, and I don't know, I don't know if this is like, you know, some sort of enlightened state of no thinking, or yes. just plain slow death, as Sarah calls it. Mm-hmm. And it clearly wasn't enlightenment.
No. I mean, were you almost afraid that you would disappear? I mean, the you that
the
is
sense.
You?
Yeah. And that's why for me, it was about part of my resistance, and part of the way I coped was an attempt to try to find different parts of myself within such a limited environment. And whether then I was becoming, had moments of like trying to hold guards' hands in the hallway just to like play with them, I had a sort of playful wrestling match with one of the guards. So it was sort of different tactics to just feel like, oh, okay, right. There's such a thing in the world as sort of joking, or there's such a thing in the world as, of course, you know, refusing to put the blindfold down, which was kind of the everyday argument that I would have with the guards.
I remember a time when we were all in solitary confinement, and we met with the Swiss ambassador, who was the kind of stood in for the U.S. And that was the first time that we had all seen each other in quite a while. And at that meeting, Josh whispered to me that he had stolen a pen from the guards, and that he would leave it in the open air cell outside in the garbage can, and I would get it. And so he did that, and had a letter in it. And I went back to my cell and read this letter, and then wrote a letter back to him. And we eventually, you know,
I remember exactly what I remember.
What did it say? You remember what it said?
I mean, I remember some of the very explicit details Shane writing about opening the how he opened the sunflower seeds that he got from the guards, and
some commentaries on Dostoevsky's The Idiot,
where like because the bathrooms are at the end of the hall, and you don't want to. You have to go there. You have to ring the button, and the guard has to take you. So sometimes you can't go immediately. So Shane wrote that he pees in his sink, and I, of course, was already peeing in my sink. So.
But I remember before that, I was kind of really in this place where I would kind of lay in my bed, and it was really hard for me some days just to get up. And there would be times that a neighbor in my in the other cell would pound on the wall, and that would kind of get me moving, and I'd pound back. But it was such a struggle. But when I got that letter and then I wrote back, I was suddenly like just flowing with energy again, just being able to write my thoughts and know that somebody would read them. And we did that for a little while. Sarah, we managed to tell Sarah about it. And then they caught us. And that month after that was probably the worst month in prison, because we were just, we had, the interrogators never came. We never saw each other. They wouldn't tell us anything. And we didn't know what was going to happen or when we would talk to anyone again.
That was my interview with Joshua Fatale, Shane Bauer, and Sarah Shroud, three American vacationers who were imprisoned in Iran for 2 years. You can learn more about what they endured by reading their book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. This is Radio Times in Review. And after the break, we'll get a historical perspective on the role that the U.S. has played in shaping Iran. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. We've been spending the hour listening to stories about Iran. But how did Iran become the nation it is today? We were joined several years ago by award-winning foreign correspondent Stephen Kinzer. He discussed at length the role that the 1953 coup d'etat, orchestrated by the CIA, played in shaping Iran and how it eventually gave rise to terrorism. He writes about why the Eisenhower administration approved the coup, how it was carried out, and the lasting effect it's had on Iran in his book, All the Shah's Men. Let's take a listen. Do you think most people know that 50 years ago the CIA overthrew a democratically elected government?
As I was working on this book, I came to believe that this was actually a very important episode that helped shape the modern world that we live in today. Nonetheless, almost nobody's aware that this even happened, myself included, having had only a very vague impression of it. This was, of course, a covert operation carried out at a time when most Americans, and indeed even most American foreign correspondents, probably could not have told you what the initials CIA stood for. It managed to remain quiet for a long time, and I think that neither that episode, the overthrow of the Iranian government in 1953, or the figure who was at the center of the episode, that is the prime minister of Iran, Mossadegh, really are remembered at all today. I found out in the course of my research that Mossadegh was such a big figure in the period when he was in active politics, that would have been in the early 50s, that in 1951, he was the Time magazine Man of the Year.
Well, you describe him as a hero of epic proportions. What made him such a popular leader in Iran?
First of all, Mossadegh was a fascinating figure just individually. He was incorruptible, which was something quite unusual in Iranian politics at that time. He had been a politician in the early years of the 20th century, but was pushed out when a dictatorship emerged to displace the early democratic regime. But then he came back to power after World War II. And at that time, there was a big anti-colonial nationalist current blowing through all of Africa and Asia and Latin America. And this current in Iran had a particular issue. Iran was dominated by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. That was a British company that had the monopoly on the extraction of all oil from Iran and kept almost all the profits for England, while the Iranians got only a small pittance. So Mossadegh came to embody the cause of nationalization of the British Oil Company. His movement was based on the idea that the wealth from Iranian oil should be used to develop Iran. With that platform, he was carried into office as prime minister and came to embody not just the nationalist feeling of Iranians, but really the anti-colonial movement that was spreading throughout the world.
How much of Iranian life was under the control of the British when they ran the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company?
The oil company provided the only sizable amount of foreign investment in Iran. And it had been unthinkable that this arrangement would ever come to an end. The British used their power to place people in and out of public office in Iran. They made sure that no one who opposed the oil company stayed in office very long. They controlled politics as well as economics. So when Mossadegh announced that he was going to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, he astonished the British, and they had to decide how to react to a kind of a threat that they had almost never faced in their entire imperial history.
If Britain and Iran were on this collision course, why did the United States get involved? What was in their interest to try to resolve this conflict between these two countries?
This is what happened with the British. They went through several stages after Mossadegh announced his nationalization. The first was denial. They just couldn't believe that those people in this faraway region, which is what they thought of Iran as being, would ever have the temerity to challenge British control of their oil company. So at first they didn't believe it. Then when it became clear it was really happening, the British decided very simply they would simply invade Iran, capture the oil fields and the refinery back, and everything would go back to normal. But President Truman went crazy when he heard this idea and made clear to the British that the United States wouldn't tolerate it. So then the British decided to take the whole dispute to the UN, and they submitted a UN resolution demanding that Iran allow the oil company to operate as before. Well, Mossadegh not only was not intimidated by the idea of the UN resolution, but he decided that he would fly to New York himself to present Iran's case. And he was so persuasive that the UN refused to embrace the British proposal. That left the British with only one more alternative, and that was they would organize a coup. And they started to do that, to try to overthrow Mossadegh. But Mossadegh found out what they were doing and did the only thing he could have done to protect himself. He closed the British embassy, and he sent all the British diplomats packing. Among them were all the secret agents who were supposed to organize the coup. So now the British had no levers left. Their tormentor was in power, and they had no agents on the ground to overthrow him. That's when they came to the Americans and asked for American help. President Truman refused.
And in 1953, had the U.S. government ever overthrown another democratically elected government or prime minister?
No. The CIA had been only in existence for a few years.
Well, Truman said no. Eisenhower said yes. And how much did the Dulles brothers, one head of the CIA, one head of the Secretary of State, become the architect of this coup plan?
They came into power with Eisenhower in early 1953, determined to try to show that they were changing what they thought was too weak an anti-communist stand on the part of President Truman and his Secretary of State. So the Dulles brothers, who saw every local conflict in the world through the lens of the East-West confrontation, were looking for a place to show that they were going to take a proactive stand against communism. Even before Eisenhower had taken the oath of office, chief members of his incoming administration had informally committed themselves to the idea that the U.S. would go in and do this deed.
And it took two tries, but how were they actually, in the final analysis, able to overthrow Mossadegh?
The first coup was predicated on the idea that a royalist military officer, that is one who supported the Shah against Mossadegh, would be named to deliver a fateful decree to Mossadegh. This would be a decree signed by the Shah telling Mossadegh that he was fired, that he was no longer prime minister. This was a decree that would have been of quite dubious legality, since in democratic Iran, only parliaments can hire and fire prime ministers. Nonetheless, the idea was that this officer would come to Mossadegh's house at midnight, deliver the decree, and then if Mossadegh resisted, as he certainly would, this officer would have soldiers with him who would then arrest Mossadegh and pronounce his overthrow. What happened was that that coup had been betrayed. During the time when it was being prepared, word got out, and other soldiers loyal to the Mossadegh government were waiting in the shadows when this officer arrived. So on the morning of the 16th of August, 1953, Kermit Roosevelt woke up to find not only that his designated prime minister was not in office and that Mossadegh had not been overthrown, but that the guy he had sent to arrest Mossadegh had been himself arrested, and therefore the entire coup seemed to have failed.
Well, and you also have then a reluctant Shah who was rather afraid of even participating in this coup.
The Shah was a very feckless, cowardly young man. He only agreed to sign that decree under great pressure from the CIA, and on condition that he be allowed to go somewhere outside Tehran in case something went wrong. Mm-hmm. The next morning after the coup, the Shah realized it had failed, and he jumped in his plane. He was a pilot himself and flew off to Baghdad. He later told the American ambassador there that he was looking for work, and he doubted he'd ever go back to Iran, and he needed to find a job. So he thought that he was out of Iran permanently.
Well, Mossadegh was arrested. He spent many years either in prison or under house arrest. And you quote him as saying to his judges, "My only crime is that I nationalized the Iranian oil industry and removed from this land the network of colonialism and the political and economic influence of the greatest empire on earth." Obviously, at that point, referring to Britain. I'm just curious about how he viewed the coup and whether he understood all that had gone into the overthrow of his government.
Mossadegh knew that foreign intelligence agencies had been involved in his overthrow. Nonetheless, I don't think he ever knew how intense the operation had been and how focused it had been. When he died, much of the information that was in my book
yeah.
was still unknown. So I think that if he could come back to life and read this book, he'd be quite surprised. There's a lot of stuff in there that nobody knew at the time of Mossadegh's death, which was only about 10 or 15 years after the coup.
After his imprisonment, then the Shah comes to power, and we know that was a time of incredible repression and brutal violence against the people of Iran. Was he immediately that way, or is that what happened as a result of the fact of how he came to power and the fact that there was so much support for Mossadegh?
The United States sent a strong message not only to Iranians but also throughout the whole Middle East by the coup that it carried out in 1953. If we had found a way to embrace Mossadegh and to encourage and support him, we would have sent throughout the Middle East the message that the United States in this post-war era is going to support democracies. I think people in other Middle Eastern countries who were young and looking forward to political careers would have heard this message very clearly, and they would have moved in a democratic direction. They would have seen that that was the direction that the rising big power in the world wanted them to go in. Instead, we sent the opposite message. We sent the message that the United States is not going to support democratic governments because those governments, first of all, will allow nationalist and even anti-American elements to have their participation in society. And secondly, the kinds of governments will restrict the access of Western powers to oil. So we sent the message that we would support strongmen, one-man rule in the Middle East. And the Shah was the first beneficiary of that policy. He went on to rule, as you said, with increasing harshness and the impossibility of peaceful resistance to his rule finally built up to such an explosive amount of resentment that the country, that the roof blew off, essentially, and the Shah was overthrown himself in that cataclysm that we now call the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79.
I think for many people who remember the Iranian hostage crisis, what we saw on display there was just how many Iranians hated the United States.
Not everybody perceives us the way we perceive ourselves. In my book, I quote a guy who was actually one of the hostage takers who has recently written an analysis of that whole episode, and he tied it very directly back to 1953. This is what he wrote. In 1953, the Shah was forced to flee Iran, but CIA agents working inside the U.S. Embassy organized a coup and brought him back. Now we're in 1979. The Shah has been once again forced to flee. He's actually been given asylum in the United States, and we're afraid that it's 1953 all over again, that CIA agents working inside the U.S. Embassy will work out a way to bring him back. And to prevent that, we invaded the U.S. Embassy.
Well, I'm wondering, too, and just sort of following some of the tentacles here, looking at the war between Iran and Iraq, the United States decided to back Iraq, headed by dictator Saddam Hussein. Can you trace that also back to this coup?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that the outbreak of Islamic fundamentalism in Iran and the emergence of such a strongly anti-American regime in Iran is what led the United States to support Saddam Hussein when he launched the great and horrifying war between Iran and Iraq. So one of the many other effects of this coup was that it led us into a military alliance that produced the building up of Saddam Hussein, another person who came back to haunt us in the future.
And did that give rise to I'm thinking of other Islamic fundamentalist militant governments. I'm thinking of Afghanistan and the Taliban.
Up until the Iranian militants seized power in the late 1970s and early 1980s, Islamic fundamentalists were imagining themselves consigned forever to the fringes of politics. These were little factions that were operating in the corners of mosques. With the triumph of Islamic fundamentalism in Iran, a lightning bolt flashed through the consciousness of a lot of these people in other countries, particularly nearby countries like Afghanistan. The message was, you don't have to be on the margins of politics. We Islamic fundamentalists, we anti-American terrorists, can actually seize power and take over whole governments. That was one of the big messages that came out of the Iran episode of 1979, and that was a message that the Taliban heard loud and clear. That's why I say that the 1953 coup produced the Shah's regime, which in turn produced the Islamic Revolution against it, and that Islamic Revolution inspired radical fundamentalists in other countries, including Afghanistan, where fundamentalist government gave shelter to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. So although it's very tricky to trace the historical causes of modern events, I think it's certainly easy to see now that the 1953 coup is a more important episode in 20th century history than most of us are aware of.
That was my 2003 interview with Stephen Kinzer, award-winning foreign correspondent who joined us to discuss his book All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Artie Moscowing. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.